Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Welcome to the Black House, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. You're in the studio today with Eddie and Eva. It's kind of a, it was good. I feel like I haven't left the house today until I had to come to here. So I'm like, it was a nice morning and I feel it's kind of not as nice as it was, but it's still all right.
It's like,
I feel like we've had a kind of weirdly nice winter so far.
It's been warm. I've liked it. And I'm miserable when the weather's bad. But today's nice. I kind of wish I didn't just rot in bed all morning.
I think that's what I'm finding kind of difficult, especially with like the amount, like just with how busy my, like, I feel like this whole week I've been applying for jobs, mm-hmm. and like just like, again, it's that sort of thing of like, I feel like I need to kind of do something to take a break, but it's also that sort of thing, I've been like, you know, I'm on my laptop, and then because I'm so focused on job hunting, and then I'm just like, well, then I want a game or I want to do something. And then it's the sort of thing, been like, I should probably leave the house today.
Yeah.
And I think, which is always a fun one, I've been like, I should probably leave the house. But
yeah, but with what money?
Yeah. And I think that's just such an interesting one when it comes to like, what people call third spaces, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
that
yeah.
sort of thing of like, and I have realized that as I've kind of, more recently, especially I guess while I have been job hunting, like while I have been kind of out of, like while I've been finishing my study and then kind of job hunting, is that sort of thing of like the new library has been like absolutely amazing, mm-hmm. in terms of having somewhere where I can go that isn't my apartment or isn't a cafe, mm-hmm. where I had to spend money. Like it's that sort of like thing of like the difficulty of like, I can't really go, there's no point, but what do I do on Cuba Street that isn't shopping?
Yeah.
Like what do I do or isn't going to a cafe that doesn't have to be, and it's not saying those things aren't fine, but it's also a thing of like, what is this really where I can just be in a space and I can read or draw or do a job application or like, I think that's what I kind of, it feels like a really interesting sort of one where I'm like,
and
I realize like, especially like, you know, my hobbies, like I collect comics and I play Magic the Gathering, and both of those are like hobbies that are kind of predicated around buying shit.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those ones where, it feels odd. And I feel like I'm trying to sit there and go like, and especially because realizing, hey, I'm not getting the same enjoyment out of these things that I used to, or like I'm kind of more interested in, like, I don't need to go to a store to play Magic the Gathering anymore. I've got mm-hmm. enough friends who can play Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
But it's that weird space of being like, well, that was, it used to be that those space, that the comic store or like Cerberus Games or one of the Magic stores around here was a space that I could just go and chill out in. But now it's like, I'm like, I'm not really regularly collecting or buying new comics anymore. Like, I'm like,
it shouldn't matter too much, no?
I feel it's the sort of thing of like, I'm going to go into then just look at comics. And if I'm not going to buy anything, then it's like, what's the kind of point of that space a little bit?
Yeah. But do you use like sort of, what do you think about like the online third spaces, like online gaming, online D&D, and
I think I'm just kind of
Twitch, Discord.
Yeah, I think I understand the value that they do have, and like I think I have like, again, like I'm in a few like artist community Discord. There's a few like art YouTubers that have Discord servers that I'm in, like, and like, so, but I'm kind of in the space where I don't think digital third spaces are a good substitute.
No.
And I think part of what I want from a third space is somewhere, like, I think part of the thing for me especially is just like, I don't really want to be like being in a digital third space. If I'm gaming online, A, it's also subscription based.
Yeah.
But B, it's, I'm trying to not be on a screen. Like, I'm trying to like cut back on my screen time, so therefore it doesn't quite make sense to me to then be like, okay, I'm gonna go, But also it is, like, and especially streaming. Like, streaming, I think...
It's so massive with young people now.
Because...
It stresses me out, but I think there's some positive, but it's, like, it's nuts. Like, what is all, like, all the neon and 6ix9ine and, like, all of these just fluoro lights and just, like, 24-hour streams of these places and gambling ads and, like... But that's mostly bots. It cannot be real people, right?
I think it is.
Clavicula, that's all bots, right?
Yeah. But I think, what if I'm streaming, like, was streaming a thing when we were in high school? Like, I feel like we were kind of like the early, like, it's interesting hearing about some of the big streamers and then realizing, oh, they were streamed, like, they were around when they were in high school. But is it a sort of thing of, like, is it kind of a pre, is there something about it that kind of feels like it felt like, even though these were big streamers, it's like the big YouTubers, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, they were much more localized. Like, they were localized to the States. So they were, you know, I feel like people, I wasn't necessarily tuning into streamers, or because I wasn't a real, like, I like playing video games. I wasn't a gamer. And I wasn't watching gamer streams and stuff like that.
Mm.
But I feel like, what do you remember? When do you remember, like, streamers kind of first kind of becoming, like, something that you really noticed in that, in the media landscape?
I think nowadays you can just be a streamer and that's it. I guess back in the day it was more, like, I don't know, I guess I used to watch, like, Cardi B or other reality TV stars on Instagram going on live and just having beefs and having, like, beefs and stuff. Like, that was kind of what the live format was used for. But then, yeah, it wasn't, like, they weren't really profiting off it. It was more, like, just time to talk live and say, get shit for the chest, usually.
Is it, like, almost the equivalent of, like, when the Kardashians first came out and it was just trashy? And like, but now it's, like, it's...
organized.
It's organized, and it's all about how they can promote all the other Kardashian stuff that they're doing in that particular year, right?
And build a massive intertwined brand.
Because,
like,
that's what I kind of noticed with... Azabi Nay has been watching Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. Like, that, like, it starts out and it's kind of...
They hook you in.
It's trashy, but now it's like, oh, we're talking about, like, it's just a feedback loop show that feeds back into their existing platforms, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of feels like sort of that early sort of streaming sort of thing where it was like, it's a wild west, it's a new frontier, it's trashy and it's unfiltered.
Yeah.
But now what's happened is like, and especially when you look at the manosphere, or you look at the kind of, like, looks maxes and all those sorts of kind of, like, subcultures, you can see now there's a grift, there's a script, there's a structure, there's an industry that you can use to generate revenue and generate views and generate revenue.
It's like, how I struggled at, like, with people who can just sit through so many ads, because anytime you sit down and, like, watch those, like, just grifters, like, it's just the most soulless, like, ads that they're doing.
Mm.
And I don't know, it can't be good to be listening to that on repeat if you're an 8-year-old kid with unlimited internet access. Like,
yeah, well, it is such an interesting one, like, because for me, like, growing up rural, like, I remember when my school got, like, 6 laptops. Like, we were a small country school. I remember when our school got, like, a donation of 10 laptops or 6 laptops for the whole school use, sort of thing. And I remember, and that was like towards, that was like, I would have been like year 5, year 6 when that happened.
Yeah.
And what's the other one? And then, like, then I remember, like, you know, and then, like, you know, when I went, started high school, that was like the second year, or either the first or the second year that the school had trialed students needing to bring their own devices.
Mm.
It was the second year. It was like, so it was that sort of thing of, like, it was right at the cusp of that sort of thing. Whereas my younger siblings, they've had devices in their schooling, especially their secondary schooling, from the get-go.
Yeah.
Versus me, where it was like most of my education, you know, there was a gradual increase of technology, but it wasn't everywhere until I was kind of 13, 14.
Mm.
And at that point, I do think there's a different, like, I think there are still, like, obviously I'm probably as addicted to my phone as everybody else, or addicted to the scroll as anybody else, but I do feel like there are ways in which, like, I can still catch myself.
Yeah.
And I still catch myself when I go, cool, I need to go do something different.
But I think that's because if you have a good foundation and balance and people around you, like, I think people who have that are fine, like, and because I work in schools, like kids who have a good foundation and are addicted to gaming or their devices and stuff, like they're usually okay. But I think it's the ones that are, I guess, like the COVID kids that have just become so completely dependent on their online communities. They've lost so many opportunities for socializing and normal social development and stuff, and now they are kind of just on their own with these online friends and servers. So like, the only like, so I've been, I got Twitch this year just to watch Ty Dolla Sign as well. And it is the most like, I struggle because it's just like the most parasocial, crazy people in there. And you can see that like the way that he talks to the ones that are just like obviously on there every single night and have nothing else going on. And it's like the comments are just like, ha ha, we're getting high with Ty Dolla Sign. It's like, oh, this is upsetting and disturbing. And
I'm like, man, if you want to get high, like, go find people around you who want to get...
or at least, like, do it alone. Like, don't share it. It's just depressing.
It's that sort of thing of, like... yeah, because I find, like, the kind of... the parasocial relationship sort of thing is it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think, to be fair, like, I think there's always been a degree of parasocial relationships that just in any media. Like, I remember, like, people talking when, like, the... This was probably like 15, 20 years ago. I remember like one of the actors on Coronation Street got into trouble for getting into a fight or drug use or something, or, you know, getting caught sniffing coke or whatever. And then there was like all the women on the, you know, there's like, and I remember like hearing like all like the women's magazines being like, oh, well, his character was like this. He wouldn't be like that. There's always that kind of level of parasocial relationship. Yeah. But I think it's the kind of, when that's your foremost friend circle, like there's a difference, there's a distinction there between someone who's like, cool, like I've been watching Coronation Street for 30 years and I kind of can't quite make, I have a kind of perception of who this actor is based on the character they've played for the past 20 of that 30 years. But then there's a little bit of difference between that, there's still like a disconnect, and that you still, the other person still has to, the viewer still has to exist in real life, they still have to kind of interact in real life. Versus, like, I think the problem with those online communities is that, like, it does just consume time.
And then it's, like, I think the ones that I have a problem with is where they're just, like, no one's getting anything out of it. Like, I think with Ty Dolla Sign's ones, like, it's half, like, I mean, a lot of them are, like, quite older women, like, not older, but, like, middle-aged women that are just so lonely and on their... but then the other side, like, he does put opportunities for young musicians, and he will, like, play, so he'll do, like, DJ nights and, like, play people's new stuff and freestyles and stuff.
Yeah, like, T-Pain really used to do that as well, and I think...
So you can, there is benefits, it's just, like, there's also, it's also a really good opportunity for really lonely people to latch onto and obsess and become...
I also think it's interesting...
More isolated.
I also think there's the parasocial, but I also think there's also a difference where you have, like, someone like Ty Dolla Sign or T-Pain, like, you have someone who, people who are... You have people who are probably a little bit older. Like, Ty Dolla Sign's, what, pushing 50? 40. Pushing 40?
Yeah.
T-Pain's probably mid-40s, I'd say.
Yeah.
And I think the distinction there between, like, versus, like, I feel like I used to have real problems with Kai Cenat and Aisha Speed, especially because, especially as young black men on those platforms, I was like,
But
I remember watching this stuff and just being like, this is minstrel. This is just, this is a minstrel show.
I don't like watching them dance around and performing and stuff. Like,
you're performing, you're performing the worst, you're kind of perpetuating the same stereotypes about black people to an audience of largely non-black people.
Well, largely little white boys that are being radicalized by different Manosphere stuff and really enjoying, like, you know, racial jokes. And with streamers, like, the thing is, like, saying the most controversial, usually the Indian song.
It gets
song
you to the
and,
top
like,
of, like, yeah.
Yeah, the more controversial ones, like, haha, you guys, who can handle it, blah, 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 like, that type of thing.
What I have seen, and I think I've kind of, Kai Cenat, like, there was a podcast I listened to, and it was a, called The Jam, and it's based, it's a couple of guys from guys probably a little bit younger than us from Chicago, and it was really cool because one of them was this guy, his Instagram handle I think was JWilliamJ8 or whatever, and he used to be, he was like in high school and he was doing takedown videos of like far right grift, like media platforms and stuff like that. He was just like constantly just like breaking down why people, like a lot of these kind of like right wing pundits like perspectives or views on race or views on left or all that sort of stuff, or gender politics or identity politics. I mean, just one of the people who blew up because he just did takedown after takedown after takedown, and was like, I think he was like a debate, kind of a debate bro, but like, you know, got invited as like an 18-year-old onto some of these right-wing guys' platforms and kind of ethered them. Just like...
Yeah.
But it's interesting because then as he's gotten a bit older, some of his mates have kind of... They just now have a podcast, and it's real cool. They've had some real cool guests. They had like Vic Mensa. They've had like Chance the Rapper on there, like, but also like consciously FD Signifier. Like a lot of those kind of like broadly kind of like, it's a mix of like, yeah, like fashion commentary, like just general cultural commentary, but also a lot of political commentary as well.
Yeah.
But one of the things they were saying is that Kai Cenat has like in his streams has shifted. So it seems like Kai Cenat is, I think, probably in his like mid-20s, probably like 24, 25.
I thought he was like way younger.
Maybe. I think Aisha Speed's like 21.
Yeah, maybe.
But like Kai Cenat is like, but even then, like Kai Cenat, he started reading on stream.
Mm.
Like he's like does 20 minutes a day and he's like actively.
Oh yeah, I think I've seen some of
that. And there's something that where I'm just like, okay, that does feel like.
If kids see that, fine.
But also I think part of the thing with that is like, there is this sort of shift where like the thing that kind of blew you up was like, yeah, you were a young kid who kind of got big right at the beginning of streaming.
Yeah, had it really from a really young age.
And like created this community, created this kind of like identity for yourself. But then, and yes, you did some minstrelly stuff or you did some like dumb shit.
Yeah.
But as you've gotten older, you've matured and been like, actually, I kind of don't know if I want to stand for that the whole time.
Yeah.
And like the other one is like Aisha Speed.
Or where going around Africa.
Going around Africa and going around the Caribbean. And it's like, or even go like when you went to China and it was that sort of thing. Like someone's like, I think still some comment is like, Aisha Speed is like weirdly almost single-handedly dismantled 50 years of US propaganda about China.
I'm so sick of.
And the same thing, I think he did the same thing within Africa as well, where it's like dismantle. And I think part of the Africa tour was that, like, there was, I remember seeing a thing where it was some like Nigerian streamers or some like Ghanaian streamers who got really annoyed that Speed wouldn't come and meet with him. And it was part of it, he was like, well, I'm not here to meet streamers.
Yeah.
I'm here to connect with the culture. I'm here to like engage with the culture. And I think, weirdly, I think like, that as a Pan-Africanist, I think there's a weird set of balance where I'm like, actually, I think Speed's done more really for Pan-Africanism in terms of dismantling stereotypes of Africa to the world.
100%.
Then probably has done more than anybody else in the past 20 years. Like maybe aside from I feel like you got the two things, like Black Panther kind of like made Afrofuturism and kind of sparked this kind of Pan-Africanism, this reignition of Pan-Africanism. And then Speed's kind of like carried that and been like, but then instead of embedding it in a fictional African context, has then been like, cool, no, these are actual African countries, actual Caribbean countries. 100%. And I think that is actually, I also think it shows a real maturity.
Mm. Also adapt as well, because I think like his, because I mean, what percentage of his audience? There's not many black people watching him, is there? Like,
I think there will be a fair few.
Like out of kind of like more like protection rather than like.
But I think like a lot
like
of
your the, lights and shit.
A lot of those guys, I think it's the sort of thing about they've just got. I think it's the thing, they've got global audiences, and I think like I remember when Speed started doing his world tours, and I remember him going to Eastern Europe and him being called the N-word, pretty consistently.
Yeah, probably not different to his streams.
But then I think and I don't know if he kind of necessarily knew how to manage that, but it does seem like with these Africa and the Caribbean tours, like, it does feel like, okay, you're approaching this much more intelligently.
Yeah, yeah.
And much more consciously.
He's got the power. I think he's definitely earned his money, stability, power to be able to make the decisions now. Whereas I guess if you're just starting out, he must have been putting himself online as a underage. He must have grown up doing it. That would have been his development, being raised by people watching him online, probably adults, young people. Like, it cannot be good, for these kids' mental health, to have that. But,
well, it's like Speed, but when you think about Nickelodeon and like just how many Nickelodeon and Disney, how many Nickelodeon and Disney stars
exactly
have just like
how many are
have
okay
come out have come out with like the most heinous reports of like, whether it's like, yeah, of the abuse, of like the sexual harassment, of like, you know, the kind of like, that kind of environment just feels really toxic. And I kind of imagine it's like, it feels like a kind of the next progression of that. Like, how do we speed run these people?
Yeah.
Like, these people's mental breakdowns, essentially.
Yeah. Because there's going to be so many streamers waiting in the background to replace them each time as well. So it's like, it's so competitive, and yet to constantly be just trying to get new kids to watch, like...
Yeah.
But then, I don't know. I think overall, like, I'm hoping with Speed's, like, tour that... You know, kids are going to be able to see the individuals, not just Africa as a whole. You know, if they're seeing online, you know, with my students, they just know Africa, black, poor, crime. Like, they know the stereotypes. Yeah. They repeat it because they're seeing it online. And those are the limitations of the stereotypes. You know, the George Floyd jokes and shit. Like, it's kind of the extent of the humor and intelligence around it. So I think, like, just even expanding it to at least be creative with the racism or be specific to the groups.
One of the things that I found interesting was when he went to the Caribbean, and like, I think when it was either when he went to Grenada or when he's to Trinidad and Tobago, but he got involved in a Jab Jab mass. Well, like, Jab Jab is like, I think it comes out of Grenada, but it's again, like, a lot of like Caribbean and like Latin American like carnival celebrations were essentially enslaved Africans taking like these European cultural celebrations, like, so like carnivals are big, like you think Venice, like the Venetian carnival is like a kind of classical kind of like example of a carnival in Europe, right? But in the Caribbean and Latin America, I think even the States as well, like those types of events enslaved Africans used those as to subvert the kind of implicit power or racial hierarchy sort of thing. And then so, for example, like, Jab Jab Mass is, like, people see a lot of comments about it online because people have that. They'll like, pour molasses all over themselves. And they're all African people, so, like, they'll pour molasses over themselves and they'll have horned helmets. And, like, you know, like, obviously, you'll get a lot of people being like, this is satanic. I was like, well, no, it's a subversion of colonial power. It's a subversion of, it's like, it's how do we take the symbols of colonial oppression and subvert them and I thought that was really cool. He went to a Jab Jab Mass and someone was like, this is not satanic, like this like this tradition, this is rooted in black resistance, rooted in this sort of thing. And I think that's the kind of stuff that I think, that's the sort of messaging I think is also really good to get.
And it's like, it's never been that either. Like, I think just even, I don't know, I think also just highlighting different random acts of black resistance that aren't talked about. I think, like, Lee is good for that as well, just saying all the New Zealand history of black people, and it's like, I have no idea about that. Like, I think just if there's someone with a massive platform who's able to just, like, be like, oh, by the way, have you ever heard of this? It's cool. Like, that is education. That's going to stick in people's minds so much easier than, you know, like, the NCA or whatever.
Yeah, it reminds me, like, one of my mates was telling me, like, how... You know when The Rock did Black Adam?
What is that movie? Like, what the fuck is that?
It did, from my understanding, it did quite well.
I don't even watch the trailer.
Compared to a lot of other... So Black Adam is the idea is that he's like a kind of hero, kind of anti-hero sort of figure. Like,
because he's black.
Because he's like... Essentially because The Rock... Because The Rock's black, he became black. He was an African because
of that. Is The Rock black?
Yeah.
I don't know that.
He's white. Okay, I want to say, black and Samoan, I want to say.
Yeah, because he's Samoan. I know he's definitely Samoan. Yeah. I don't know he's black.
Yeah, he's...
You sure?
He's like a quarter black or half black.
Okay. I mean, still weird casting. Is the black part in Black Adam because of his skin tone?
No, so like, it's because...
Because he's an anti-racist. Because he's evil.
Do you want me to do... Okay, this is comic book lore. So like, Black Adam originates as a villain... to the superhero Captain Marvel or Shazam. Shazam is this idea of like he's a teenage boy who encounters like a wizard, and because he's like, you know, pure of heart and good, like he gets transformed into essentially like a Superman type figure called Captain Marvel, or due to some rights issues, Shazam. But so the idea is that he transforms into this character by saying the word Shazam, and that gives him the strength of Hercules. I think it's the strength of Hercules, I can't remember what the H is. I can't remember exactly, but essentially it's an acronym, so it's like tied to different gods that give him his kind of powers. He gets the wisdom of Solomon. So then, like, the strength of Atlas, like the lightning powers of Zeus and that sort of thing, like the agility of Mercury or speed of Mercury. And then so Black Adam is like, he's an early, he's like, I think he's, depending on the version, he's either Egyptian or he's kind of nebulously, like from a nebulous kind of Middle Eastern, North African, Northeast African country.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a slave thousands of years ago and was the first, like an old of the first Shazam essentially, but then turned to evil, like used his powers for evil. So his powers derive from the strength from the Egyptian gods as opposed to like the kind of Greek, kind of Greco-Roman sort of gods.
Right.
But as it's kind of, so that was like, and he's a character from like, I want to say like the 1930s.
Right.
Like Shazam is okay, like, Captain Marvel is one of like the oldest superheroes in existence. So then, and the idea was that, in the original thing, Black Adam was banished to the other side of the universe and essentially spends 3,000 or 5,000 years flying back to Earth through space.
Yeah.
But in more kind of modern renditions of him, what happens is that he's like a, some versions him and his nephew or him and his son grow up in slavery. They beseech the kind of gods for help, and then either his son dies and then he gets the powers, and then he then kind of goes on like a, you know, rampage and like, you know, tears down the oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
But then in other versions, his son is the one who's selected to gain the powers, and he kills his son and takes the powers because his son's like too good. He's like, we're gonna like, yes, obviously we're gonna we could build a better world, and he's like, I just want to tear down the oppressors' shit, our oppressors' stuff. And then so he kind of becomes like a bit of a Dr. Doom figure, because he kind of then like he rules this country called Kandak. So essentially like he returns to his homeland after like 5,000 years, this nebulous kind of Middle Eastern, North African kind of country, throws out the kind of either the colonial oppressors or like the existing kind of like dictators that rule it.
Yeah.
And then kind of becomes like a benevolent dictator.
I mean, I'm just...
And then to the Rock...
He's not suited... Like, this is way too much for his little brain. He's so brain damaged.
The thing is the Rock... I think the reason why they picked him, and it's this sort of thing... No, it was because, you know, The Mummy Returns...
Mm.
Where he's the Scorpion King. He's like the bad CGI half man, half scorpion. They did a prequel, so this is like The Mummy with Brendan Fraser and that sort of thing. So that film was what kickstarted The Rock's career,
right?
Because he showed up as the Scorpion King in The Mummy Returns as like the kind of big bad antagonist, and then they did a spin-off film about the Scorpion King, and again it was very much like, it was essentially about a Nubian warrior who overthrows like an oppressive kind of like, you know, warlord or whatever.
Yeah.
And he becomes the Scorpion King.
Mm.
And that's what kickstarted The Rock's acting career. Like, you know, weirdly, like, I think he was it was in the same vein of like, I watched Arnold Schwarzenegger do Conan the Barbarian. Like, it's a good, cheesy hack and slash action movie that doesn't need great acting.
See, he was good in, is it The Tooth Fairy? It was him, right? Like, he was great in it. I think he should stick to just being
comedic,
steroided up.
But yeah, apparently The Smashing Machine is actually quite good. Like, that's his most recent one, and it's a serious film.
He should stick to I love WWE. Like, it's, just stick to that drama. Mm. Like, that's, I think that level of acting and the campness of...
And I think that's what Black Adam was kind of a cool film because it kind of had some of that camp.
Okay.
But then I think...
It's for kids, right?
No, it was kind of for kids. It was just like, I guess, like most superhero movies where it's like PG, kind of maybe M-rated.
Yeah.
And it was pretty, he was relatively okay in that. I feel like there were definitely bits where you would tell, like, things that annoyed me in that. I'm just like, just give him an accent. Like, if he's supposed to be like a 5,000 year old, like,
I don't think he can do
a 5,000 year old, like warlord or like from like Nubia, from like Nubia or like kind of like northeastern Africa, he should have an accent. Mm. But it was weird because it was a film that lawyers like, but again, the film was about him coming, him being like returned or being freed from a kind of prison that he'd been trapped in. Mm. And then throwing like, and then uprising and freeing this nation, Kandak, from a like Western corporation, like Western, mm-hmm. kind of Western backed kind of corporate takeover. Mm-hmm. And it was like a sort of thing. And like, it was, I can't remember what else came out in that year, but there was a couple of other films that came out in the year with a similar kind of like slightly anti-colonial, but like, or that were, or no, from, let's say, were that were more explicitly anti-colonial or more explicitly about like African resistance or African resistance of white supremacy or African resistance against invasion. I think Ping might have been the same year that Black Panther 2 came out. Mm. But people gravitated towards Black Adam because it was kind of still like a big kind of dumb schlocky kind of action film.
Yeah.
And I think that's the sort of thing that I think IShowSpeed kind of has. It's like, obviously, yes, it's good to have academics and well thought out and like really quality media that explores these ideas, explores these themes. But sometimes you also just need like
culture,
the, like the kind of like the thing that's just appealing to everybody, yeah, which is like, is, it doesn't need to be particularly intellectual,
it's entry
but
level,
it gets the messages across, right?
Yeah. It's a starter introduction, and like, you know, everyone's interested in different countries and cultures and stuff, like that's the easiest thing to give fun facts about of where you're from, and like kids love to ask where people are from and love to learn the differences and stuff. But I think like with streamers, all they're showing is these like limited, you know, with Jewish people, it's just like rubbing hands memes and, you know, like just the limited, really boring stereotypes. And it's like, not even creative. It's just so lazy.
I also think it's interesting because it's that sort of weird space when you think about, like, obviously the time that we kind of came up on the internet, like,
it was the Wild West, but like, it was
the Wild West, but also like, it's interesting seeing, who was I talking to? I was talking about something the other day and it was talking about, but it was talking about obviously like the edgelord, like the rise of the edgelord, and obviously how that went
from
being
edgelord's dead now,
but then how specifically that went, that progressed as an ideology from being like kind of teenagers or young people being kind of saying the most extreme stuff online, but then how that then flowed very directly into what is now the contemporary far right.
Mm.
And that's like, that's not even conspiratorial.
Yeah,
like,
it's not funny anymore. They're not having fun anymore.
And it's not even conspiratorial because like, that's literally what happened. Like Steve Bannon, who was one of Trump's advisors, kind of made his money, weaponized, like realized, was involved in like a scheme with World of Warcraft. Essentially that was like what a lot of online video games happen. If you could like buy accounts that had, you'd unlocked everything for you or all that sort of stuff. And then what happened was, is then there was a mass gamer community backlash or mass gamer community protest of some of these things these companies were doing that, like, very, that, like, the vitriol and, like, the kind of organization and the ferocity at which these gaming communities went after the game studio for implementing a change.
Mm.
And Steve Bannon was like, that's what the right needs, that that's and then spent the better part of this is like the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. Steve Bannon then spent the better part of 20 years essentially weaponizing the gamer community into a that kind of framework of vitriolic, like acidic, toxic kind of like like aggression and like protest and kind of boycott, all that sort of thing, that kind of action, and then spent the better part of 20 years weaponizing that so that it could become the basis for the far right's kind of
100%. But also like with the online communities and like the amount of isolation that comes if you're just in these online gaming communities, like it makes you so, if all of your circle from your online third space is saying and doing this shit and getting so angry and heated and heightened about it, like it's gonna rub off.
And also just how desensitizing it is, like, and one of the big ones is like how like racial slurs and like sexual slurs and rape threats became just standard parlance of video game, like audio video game chat. I remember seeing a Reddit post a few years ago, and it was a guy, it was like an Am I the Asshole, it was either an Am I the Asshole or an Ask, it might have been an Ask Men post.
Yeah.
But it was a guy being like, so my It's like, it was like I'm a white guy, I'm dating a black woman, and then, like, where I, like, spend a lot of my time playing Call of Duty and that sort of stuff. And then, like, you know, sometimes it's just literally just playing the speakers out loud. And then, obviously, then, like, some of the, you know, people in those spaces started dropping the N-word. And his girlfriend or his wife was like, can you, like, actually tell him to shut it down? And obviously, in those spaces, the thing is, it's because it's so normalized, it's happened so frequently, he was just like, I just ignore it. And his wife was, his girlfriend was like, well, no, like, you shouldn't ignore it. You should absolutely call it out. But then it's the sort of thing he's like, but, and then his rationale was like, well, they're just going to double down and do it more. But it's that sort of thing. And he was like, and then all the comments were like, a lot of it was like, again, people, I think it was because it was a male kind of Reddit forum. A lot of guys was like, yeah, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Like, you just ignore it. And I was just like, look, I'm coming from a point where, like, I understand. Like, I've known those kind of gamer spaces. Like, I've seen my mates and those people in those spaces. The difference is that your girlfriend, like, the important thing in this here is that your girlfriend heard that you were in a space with, like, racial slurs and racial abuse was thrown around regularly, and you did nothing.
Yeah, and you're more comfortable in that space than to challenge
it. And you're comfortable just letting that sit. And unfortunately, it's like, for her, like, as a black woman, she doesn't get the liberty of deciding, like, how, if she gets to ignore that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And what you've just shown is that you won't stand up for her.
Exactly.
And there's that sort of thing where it's just like, and I understand this sort of thing, and I think it's really difficult, like, you know, when you have trolls, like, trolling is just such a nasty sort of thing because there is that degree
they
of,
they always win.
They always want to get, like, well, there's, I've been trying to apply to, like, all my online discourse recently. I've been trying to apply a specific frame of logic, which is, if you wrestle with a pig, you both get covered in shit and the pig enjoys it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, like, how I view kind of online trolls. But there's there's this sort of thing of, like, you kind of just have to avoid those spaces. But, again, that's the kind of pervasion of those spaces, or those spaces where, like, really horrifically misogynistic or really horrifically racist or really horrifically, like Islamophobic or anti-Semitic, the ferments in those spaces, is because you can't, because if you engage and challenge it, then those spaces do just dogpile on you.
And you're no longer welcome in them. And if that is your only, like, social circle, and that is your main, I mean, the Reddit guy, like, he's obviously prioritizing this online community over his girlfriend.
Yeah.
If that's your, like, biggest source of, like, socialization and your community, like, to challenge that, like, it's impossible. And I think with young people just growing up in these spaces and that's all they have, and, like, you can either have friendship and connection or be on your own and be the bitch who doesn't like the N-word, like.
And then sometimes it's the kind of thing of, like, one of the things I'm noticing recently is, like, if you have community spaces, like, and it's not, and it's like, yeah, like, it's like Reddit, for obviously 4chan is kind of like, 4chan is obviously like Twitter, like Facebook, they're like just WhatsApp, all stuff. They're just Telegram. They're just all these things are just unraveling the fabric of social cohesion and democracy.
Yeah.
But it's a sort of thing of sometimes, like I've been trying not to get into online arguments, but it's also sometimes I'm just being like, I know I'm not trying to argue with the person who's saying stuff, but if they're just continually allowed to post and say whatever vile, kind of, like, ill-informed, like, like, wrong or intensely biased stuff that they, whatever they put up there.
Yeah. Naming no names in the African political chat.
But no, for real, like, I look at it and go,
it shouldn't be allowed at all.
But I look at it and go, you can't just let that person or let those individuals or let those kind of communities, like, it's best to ignore them, like, even if you ignore them 80% of the time, you can't just let them have all the airtime always, because otherwise, because you're never going to necessarily convince the person who you're actually debating with or arguing with. But I also think there's value in someone, in, if someone is a constant, is a regular contributor in a forum, I think there is value in saying, cool, like, there are other opinions that could, like, this person isn't necessarily an authority on the things that they post or things that they're saying. And it's that sort of thing of being like, it's not, I think the thing I always hear is, like, it's not about winning the argument with the person you're talking to. It's about reaching the people who see that.
Yes,
it's 100%. About making sure that
yeah.
the people around who see that
that you're
know,
challenging it,
know
so
that this
defending
isn't,
them.
If yeah, and it, and it's like so they know that there is that these are views that can be challenged
yeah.
or can should be challenged,
and that there is consequences for being a dick and being like a dick that isn't listening over and over. Like I think that that's one of the things I think with like a lot of these spaces, the loudest voice, like it just becomes normalized for it not to be challenged. And I think like, you know, if one person's the only one who's challenging them, they're going to get dogpiled on, or they're going to be like ignored, or they're going to get emotionally drained by being the only one who's engaging
yeah.
with these idiots. And like, it's so like the best ally thing to do is just like step in and take over and take some
yeah.
of that burden, because it's exhausting.
Have you seen the Louis Theroux Manosphere
no,
documentary?
Not yet.
I watched it recently. I watched, and it's pretty grim, but it was interesting because it was like Louis Theroux, like obviously he's had his documentary. He's like a British documentarian. He's been doing this for 30 years almost, probably, I'd say.
Yeah.
And his kind of style is that he's like a kind of slightly kind of awkward, like awkward kind of kind
disarming.
Of foppish, like not particularly like mad, like in the context of the Manosphere thing,
yeah.
not fitting their kind of idea of what a masculine man is.
Yeah.
But it's very disarming. Historically, it's been very disarming in those spaces. So if you're probably our age, you remember, like, the documentary that I remember he was really famous for was Westboro Baptist Church, which was a evangelical church in the US that was, like outwardly just racist and homophobic and, like, blew up. It was, like, very early online kind of, like, hate group, essentially. But he was the person who went into the Westboro Baptist Church and then kind of did a documentary essentially, you know, looking at that whole community. And he did a documentary towards the end of last year, but earlier this year, that was looking at the Manosphere. So it was looking at Myron Gaines, Fresh and Fit, looking at Sneeko, looking at these kind of like these TikTok and stream and YouTube influencers, and obviously these influencers who push this very strong, very like aggressively toxic, like again, it is toxic,
yeah.
but these like regressively nasty views on relationships and women
with no social skills, and that's these COVID kids.
It's like Andrew Tate is probably the most notorious one, like known sex trafficker, Andrew Tate. Just to be fair, but it was interesting where. There are kind of two things that I kind of took away from that documentary is I thought it was really interesting because Louis Theroux's been married for 30 years.
Mm.
And he was obviously, as part of his documentary, he went on Fresh and Fit, so Myron Gaines' podcast, and then kind of actively called them. Like, it was like, I think, well, hey, but I've been married for 30 years. Like, I think the things you're saying are actually really, really harmful to tell young boys, especially about this is how relationships should be.
Yeah.
This isn't how relationships are.
Yeah.
The other thing that was really funny is that he consistently, what happened where these guys access to a lot of these guys shut down was because he started talking to their girlfriends.
Mm.
Or he started talking to, like, Fresh and Fit. Like, Fresh and Fit's whole model is that they bring on like OnlyFans model, like models or
influencers,
like OnlyFans women who, again, no shade to people who do OnlyFans, but people who are not necessarily equipped to have conversations and rationally deal with conversations in those
yeah.
circumstances, right? And like, he's dumb. He's essentially reaching out to other dumb people
yeah.
to like then poke fun at how dumb they are.
They also hate these women. Like, I mean, Clavicula is so clearly gay. And it's like, it's a lot of these just feel like a weird psyop to try and just, I don't know, just purposely like poison young, like, brains.
Yeah.
It's just like, who is, like, they're women, like, it's so, like, clinical the way they talk about how hot these women are. And it's like, there's no way they're attracted to them.
But the Fresh and Fit thing was really funny because they, like, essentially, the people who work for this, that he speaks to, essentially, and it kind of felt like the woman who procures all the other women for these shows. And he's talking to her, and then, like, Fresh and Fit, like, this is before he goes on their show, he's actually involved in the show. And it was really funny because this woman, like, they're filming the podcast while he's talking to this woman,
nice.
And you can see them start, like, panicking a bit and being like, shit, 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 he's talking to...
Yeah.
One of the people who works yeah. for us, and this sort of woman, and again, this woman who was like, it was both infuriating but also kind of sad. Where it's very clear, it's like, you don't like what you're doing, but this is a job, and you get paid. And
yeah.
I can't, like, I think you should probably grow a backbone and some moral principles, but it's that sort of thing of like, but your job is literally to go to scroll through Instagram models and invite them to come on, because it's, but what I found specifically interesting was that
it's Ghislaine Maxwell's shit, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. But then the thing I found really interesting was that, and he kind of comments on it, is that it was a new space to be in, where like usually when he's doing these documentaries, it's just his cameras there. Versus with these documentaries, with these influencers, where he's constantly being filmed by their teams as well, specifically. And then you can see how things that they're doing, like how the questions he's asking, or like the how they're clipping his his interactions with them to frame him as either supporting or framing him as like a real, as a loser, like a beta male, all that sort of thing, right? And I thought that's, I think that's what I find interesting, found specifically interesting, was that that landscape, that media kind of, media landscape kind of shifts, where it's like, even like, it's one, from being one-sided to being kind of like, there's no multiple kind of cameras, there's no multiple perspectives, there's multiple edits of this.
Well, it breaks the, through the, because I think like, it is so organized and structured streaming now that like, you know, for the most part, no one else is allowed in there. And I think, like, so 6ix9ine is an example where he's kind of, I don't know, I mean, he's nuts, but like,
isn't like the rapper 6ix9ine?
Yeah. So he's out of prison now, and he's capitalizing on that, and he's friends with Neon, and he's made this, like, the most, like, kind of evil, like, remember Hype House? Like, he's kind of made a Hype House where it's just, like, everything's rainbow and bright for young children. Like, he's targeting young children to watch his streams where he, like, uses slurs and makes fun of the races of the other streamers, like the Jewish one and the, like, just whatever. And it's just like, I don't know, there's the way that it's so controlled and like no one else is in there. He has complete control over what gets shown. So it's like, you know, if he doesn't want to talk about being a snitch, like he doesn't have to, or he doesn't, he only releases clips where he's making fun of himself. So it's like he's owning it. And it's like, it's just such a, if you're not media literate and you're a young kid just going, like, discovering those things and not able to question, that's why I think, like, you know, everyone, I think kids should be watching the Louis Theroux one if it really breaks down the behind the scenes of how it actually works. Like,
kids should, I think parents should.
Well, parents can't. Yeah. I mean, remember when we were growing up, like, you know, I had complete unlimited internet access and our parents couldn't keep up. You know, like, when devices were introduced when we were in high school, it was a constant battle of, okay, now they've introduced, you know, the smooth wall things, and then now it's, we're using VPNs.
Yeah.
And then what can they do? They can't do shit. And because they don't know how to, to beat our minds and how to, like, we'll hide our phones better than they could ever. Like, we always found ways to get around it. And, like, I'm finding the same with, and if one student has social media unlimited, that means all of them do, because if one kid has a phone, they can show the rest
of them. Yeah.
So it's like, there's no, I don't think there is any way to, reduce, like, I think we just have to kind of accept that all kids are going to be watching really traumatizing porn from a very young age.
See, I disagree in the sense that I think, and I, because I'd sit there and go like, I would say like my upbringing was very much, was quite restrictive when it came to technology, and like to a point where like my family was pretty, my mum was pretty overly strict when it came to tech, sort of stuff. And I think yes, there's the sort of thing of like, there's the ways in which those things, how it's harder and harder to avoid it. But I do think there are ways in which, like, I think, for example, like when I'm thinking about having, when, if I have kids, right, like part of it is being like, well, what do I introduce, what kind of level of technology do I introduce to them at what age, and how do I, and obviously, yeah, maybe I can't stop what their friends show or what their friends have, or the degree of connectivity or the degree of things that their friends have. But what I would like to try and do, and then again, as a parent, the only thing you can do is try. What I'd like to try and do is to be like, really strongly regulate their access to stuff. And then once they start hitting those kind of ages, for example, right, it's been like, hopefully we've, like, the way you've kind of grown up, the way you've kind of thing, means that you can, you have a degree, even if it's a fraction more of a degree of self-regulation than your friends do.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think, like, I think it does come back to building up that foundation. Like, I think, like, if you have a kid, like, so one of my coworkers said something recently, so we're, you know, there's a couple of kids that have unlimited access to iPads, and I was kind of like, trying to avoid a kid from seeing what was on the screen because she was younger. And, and then he was just like, well, if you've seen something traumatizing, then that's on her. And I was like, actually, I really like that because, yeah, she knows she's not meant to look at it. She was told that, you know, so like she had the information and it was kind of like, I don't know, I think that, like, you know, I was watching ISIS beheading videos at 11. My friends were showing me porn all the time. Like, we'd watch it together, like, just out of curiosity. And we knew, and, you know, remember, like, Two Girls, One Cup, we had all these gross-out challenges and stuff. We knew how to shut off the screen and return to, like, playing outside. I don't know. I think there's a balance.
I think, yeah, because I remember, like, yeah, like, when I was at school, like, that was, like, I remember there was one of the older students got kicked out because he got caught distributing porn to the younger students. Yeah.
But again, there's always one thing,
but then I think a lot of guys, like, a lot of the guys at school, it doesn't know, I was in a boarding house, and, like, someone's older brother, like, that was the sort of thing. It was, like, again, it was those weird sort of things, and I do understand what you mean. Like, those things do just exist in those spaces, and it is really hard to but
some kids respond way better. Some kids can get completely, permanently, like, addicted to porn from those interactions, and some kids are completely fine.
And I think, like,
well, not completely fine, but, you know.
Yeah.
And they cope.
I think it's that sort of thing of, like, it's that kind of thing of, I think it's a two-prong. I think what we're saying is, like, we're almost approaching it from the same thing from the two different things. It's like you both simultaneously need to give kids the ability to self-regulate a bit more, but then also you have the ability to kind of, like, even if it's to be able to talk about something that if their friends show them something that makes them feel a certain way, or makes them feel, like, I think that building an environment where your kid can come to you and be like, I saw this.
Yeah.
Like,
and also preparing them for it. Be like, by the way, you might see
things like this.
Dicks. If you're going to be on if you're going on Discord in your games, you're going to see dicks. Like, that's going to happen. This is what a penis looks like. This is biologic. Like, you know, give them some age appropriate education about porn. Like, I think everything can be made age appropriate. And I think giving them a heads up about the risk of what they're doing by going into online spaces, online safety, like, I think there's really simple education and harm reduction that you can do for young people to sort of make them cope with being online. They're not going to be able to avoid it.
And I think there's also the sort of thing of, like, it always comes down to, like, if you could, like, yeah, like you said, you're never going to be able to avoid, like, your kids having some connectivity online.
Yeah.
But I think, like, and again, I think a lot of parents, I think there needs to be, I feel like a lot of parents, it's that sort of thing of, like, there just needs to be a little bit more thought into, and
but their parents are dumb. They don't understand technology.
But that's what I'm saying. But I think as a parent, like, you might not understand it, but I think you need to understand, I think that is part of being a parent in the 21st century, is you actually do need to understand this enough.
Well, educate. I think the Manosphere thing was really good. So I saw lots of the older co-workers and parents and stuff were like, oh my God, I had no idea. All of the, like, with, what's it, Adolescence, when that came out.
Yeah, that was huge. The red pill, blue pill,
like, they had no idea about any of it. And I was like, that's really fucking scary that they had no idea about any of this stuff.
But also, I think it's like, the reason why a lot of parents don't have an idea of us is, I don't think it's not necessarily just they don't understand the technology, but it's also the fact of just like, well, if both your parents have to work.
Where's the time to watch the 8-hour stream of.
Where's that ability to kind of necessarily really kind of engage with the things that you're. Or if you're. If your thing, you both get home from work and you need to put dinner on the table and you need to get through things, it's very easy just to tell your kid, just go watch TV, just go iPad. Yeah. And also
dismiss it. I mean, so brain rot is the one that I've been so fascinated with brain rot recently. Like, my whole algorithm, I've made it specifically, I keep clicking like, yes, yes, I want more brain rot, because it's, number one, it's really funny. And, like, the way that it's such a response to, like, certain generations just thinking that Gen Z is so fucking stupid and like, but the level of thought and creativity that goes into some of these videos, I'm like, this is really good.
I find it interesting because I've seen it on Instagram, a couple of times. There's a neurologist, I want to say, he's like a child, like, yeah, like a childhood neurologist sort of thing, and his whole thing is he essentially gets given TV shows, like kids' programs, and essentially ranks them based on, like, the levels of stimulation, like, what kids get out of them sort of thing. And I thought that was really interesting in terms of not just, again, like, A, looking at, like, the moral lessons and stuff that, and, like, the kind of, like, the actual story elements of